sunside, but huge and pure white, which hid indistinguishably in the snow and ice to leap out on unwary wanderers. But again, he would see what he could see. None of these things held anything of terror for him. They were life, and life is blood, and conversely, as in an old Vampiri saying, the blood is the life. For the equivalent of 2.5 days Earth time, Scythus flew steadily north, until at the end of one huge glide, and when it was time for his flyer to climb again, he spied bears basking in sunlight on a floe at the rim of an ice-crusted sea. Scythus's flyer was tired, its fats, liquids, and metamorphic flesh depleted. Starside had been cold, but the Icelands were colder far. This place would be as good as any to stop and rest a while, and Scythus was tired too, and hungry. Where a cliff of ice towered over the sea, he brought his flyer down, commanding it to remain there while he strode out along the frozen shore. The elevation of the place would make it a good launching platform when it was time to get underway again. A quarter mile away, the bears sensed his coming. A pair of them towered on their hind feet on the tilting floe, sniffing the air suspiciously and grunting their annoyance. They were females, and cubs tumbled from underfoot as they commenced to roar their furious warnings. Scythus smiled grimly and came on. Their roaring was a challenge. His Vampiri nature reacted to it. His face elongated and needle teeth scythed through the cartilage of his jaws and gums like an eruption of bone daggers. His mouth filled with the salt taste of his own blood, and that too served to speed his monstrous metamorphosis. The vampire lord was only an inch or two less than 7 feet tall, but the she-bears, where they rumbled and roared on the float of ice and threatened to tip it over, were all of that and 12 inches more at least. Their paws were 3 times the size of Scythus's hands and tipped with claws sharp enough to spear fish dead in the water at a thrust. And, ah, he thought, good strong flesh. And ferocious fighters born, what warriors I could build from such as you. Now he was only 100 yards away, and that was too close for the nursing mothers. Plunging into bitter, slapping wavelets, they struck out from the shore. They'd see this creature off or kill him. If the first, good enough, and if the second, well, he'd make good red meat for the cubs. Scythus, 50 yards away from them, where they left the water and shook themselves on all fours like huge white shaggy dogs, took his war gauntlet from his hip and thrust his right hand into it.
Come on then, ladies,
he urged with his telepathic mind, not knowing if they heard him and caring less.
For I've come a long hungry way, and a cold hungry way yet to go.
Still, his hand was only 2/3 the size of one of theirs, but deadlier far. He spread wide his fingers inside the gauntlet, and the grotesque palm was a great rasp of cutting edges, blades, and scythes. And clenching his hand as nearly as possible to a fist, razor spines stood up inches from the knuckles, and 4 sharp-filled iron punches sprang out to point forward like ramrods. The bears were charging, the smaller one, but only inches smaller, leading the larger one. Scythus had chosen the site of the battle. He shrugged off his cloak, stood tall and central on a flat cake of ice frozen in a field of sharp, jumbled ice boulders. The bears were disadvantaged, came slipping and sliding over the rough terrain. They roared, and the vampire lord roared back, which served to increase their fury. Before, Scythus had appeared more or less human. Now he was anything but human. His skull had elongated to that of a wolf. The gape of his mouth was enormous, where white needle teeth meshed like those of a shark. His long and sloping nose had broadened and flattened to his face, growing convoluted and sensitive as the snout of a bat. Even if he were blinded, that snout and his whirl-like ears would track the movements of his opponents as surely as his scarlet eyes. His right hand, inside its gauntlet, had expanded to fill that fearsome weapon and give it yet more weight, while his left hand was now lizard-like and taloned, whose fingers were tipped with sharp chitin chisels. So that for all his man-like silhouette, in fact he had become a composite warrior creature, Vampiri. The leading she-bear came at a shambling run, rearing upright as she entered the arena of battle. Scythus let her come and at that last moment crouched low and hurled himself forward into her massive legs. He clung there, reached round behind, hamstrung her with one clawing rake of his gauntlet. Howling, she crashed down on him, and before he could escape the tangle, tore open his back to the spine. The moment he felt the pain, he killed it, willed it away, and kicking himself free of the crippled bear, he looked for its larger companion. She was on him. Huge paws groped for him where he skidded on his damaged back, and crushing jaws fastened in the left forearm he held up before his face for protection. But as her great head worried at his arm and her claws tore his body, so Scythus swung his gauntlet in a deadly arc. It smacked against her head, demolishing her left ear and slicing into the eye, so that she at once reared upright and away, dragging Scythus to his feet. His left arm had been released but was crushed, temporarily useless. If she should fasten those great jaws of hers around his neck or shoulder, he'd be finished. Blooded and roaring her pain and fury, she shook her red, torn head and sent pearls of blood flying in Scythus's eyes. He ignored them and, as she lured her jaws towards his face, thrust his gauntlet direct into her yawning cave of a mouth. Teeth like the heads of claw hammers sheared as the gauntlet crushed through them. Scythus drove that terrible weapon in deeper yet, wrenched it to and fro, enlarging her throat, then tore downwards into her gullet. She staggered this way and that, her great arms beating uselessly. Scythus opened his gauntlet in her mouth, wrenched it free, dislocated what was left of her bottom jaw. She'd not bite him now, and while still she flailed, he swung his gauntlet again, this time with its iron punches extended. They slammed into her skull, through the red debris of her ear, and crushed the delicate bone inwards, penetrating her brain. She was done. She puffed and snorted and swayed, pouring uselessly at the empty air. Scythus gathered all his remaining strength to drive his gauntlet one last time through the ruin of her flapping jaw and into the back of her throat, where he gripped, crushed, and severed the spinal column. Virtually decapitated, she was dead on her feet for a single moment, and in the next, the ice shook as her great body thudded down upon it. Scythus leapt on her, buried his awful face in the pulp of her head, filled himself with steaming crimson. The blood is the life. In a while he stood up. A small distance away, the other bear left a trail of blood where it crawled in crazy patterns on the ice, dragging its useless rear leg behind it. Scythus fought down his own pain as he went to the crippled creature. When chance permitted, he ripped away the muscles and tendons first from one foreleg, then the other. When finally the bear was totally incapacitated, he tore open her throat and let out the remaining bulk of her life, steaming onto the ice. And again he took hot, reeking blood, and felt himself grow stronger. Some little distance away his flyer nodded its great swaying diamond-shaped head at the top of the ice cliff. Scythus stood up and commanded it, "Come!" The thing came, slipping and slithering at the rim, its many legs uncoiled like whipping snakes to thrust it into its launch, and it soared over the sea, then dipped over huge manta wings, turned, and came back. It settled to the ice a respectful distance away, then, at Scythus's insistence, came flopping to where the carcass waited. Meanwhile the vampire lord had cut out the great smoking hearts of the bears and put them in a pouch for later. He backed off and sat down on a stump of ice, and...
"Eat," he commanded his flyer. "Fuel yourself."
And in the streaming moon and starlight, the changeling beast took back much of its lost heat, fats and liquids.
"I eat well,"
Scythus told it.
"There'll be no more strong meat like this anywhere. Not until I'm healed anyway."
And then gradually, he let all his pain free to creep in on him, the agony of his split back and crushed arm, and his broken ribs where they'd tested the bear's pummeling. Pain, great pain. His vampire felt it, all the more spur to that thing within him to be about the healing. Pain, aye. There were times like this, after a battle hard fought and won, when pain was warmer than the warm, succulent core of a woman. It was Scythus's pride to let it wash over him, and to feel the scars of his body start to heal. Perhaps he would keep some of them open, or scabbed at best, as mementos of his victory. Except, who would be there to admire them? After a flight as long again, finally Scythus spied the ice castles where they gleamed under the serpentine writhings of polar aurora. They could only be stacked eerie, surely. His heart beat faster in his great breast. Vampiri here? What manner of creature would they be, dwelling in the sub-zero temperatures of the Icelands? Albinos like the mythical bats, growing their own white fur for warmth? What would be their sustenance? And perhaps more to the point, how would they react to Lord Scythus? He took his flyer up to higher altitudes, the better to spy upon the ice-locked land around. Further north, possibly at the northernmost extreme, a string of dead volcanoes thrust up their crater cones through ice and drifted snow. In both directions, east and west, they dwindled away as far as Scythus's eyes could see, marching out of view across glittering, icy horizons. Some were cased in ice, others showed their naked stone, from which Scythus deduced that the unclad mountains must still retain a measure of their former fire. To reinforce his opinion, he noted that the central and largest cone even appeared to issue a little smoke. But the effect came and went, and could be an illusion of the general dazzle. Star dazzle and auroral dazzle. The entire roof of the world was lit as by some weird blue daylight. Not that light was especially important to the Vampiri, no, for the night was their element. Eyes such as theirs could see even in the darkest places. As for the ice stacks, Scythus gave them his keenest possible scrutiny. They were mere molehills compared to the once mighty bone and stone shacks of Starside, and even the tallest would be less than half the height of the lowest airy. Where they were not coated with snow, it could be seen that their ice was of the purest. Like vast inverted icicles, they grew up in concentric circles away from the central volcano. Also, where the light struck through them at their peaks, he saw that they were pure ice through and through, but at their bases, many seemed to have stony cores. Perhaps in its heyday, the central volcano had thrown out great gobs of stuff all around, forming splashes of hot rock on these rippling rings, like a handful of mud tossed into a pool. And then, through the centuries, ice sheaths had accumulated, gradually building into these jagged, sharply pointed stacks. It seemed as likely an explanation as any. That the ice castles were not fit habitations seemed obvious at first, and Scythus might well have flown on, but then he saw what looked like an exhausted, indeed frozen, flyer at the base of one such castle, and went down for a closer look. Again, choosing an ice cliff's rim for landing site, he left his flyer and walked a half mile to that which he had seen from on high, lying crumpled in frozen snow. A flyer, aye, much rimmed, emaciated, and seemingly dead. Seemingly. But no one knew better than Scythus of the Vampiri how hard it was to actually kill such a creature. Like the vampire lords who made them, they were created to endure. He sent a telepathic message to the brain of the great diamond-shaped blanket of a thing, all of 50 feet across its wingtips, that it should stir itself, rise up. It did no such thing, which hardly surprised him. Their small brains were rarely attuned to any mind other than their master's. But he might have expected a small twitch of curiosity at least, if only for the fact that some strange vampiric lord had issued the beast an instruction, however invalid. There had been no such twitch, wherefore its brain must be dead. Likewise, of course, the great envelope of flesh which enclosed it. Then, clambering over the cold humped ridge of its central body to the base of its neck, at the forward junction of wings, Scythus spied its saddle and trappings, and recognized the familiar blazon of its maker-master tooled into the leather. A face in caricature, grotesque and distorted from its weight of mighty wens and warts, and then Scythus smiled his sardonic smile and nodded. The flyer had been the Lord Pinescu's creature. Vols Pinescu, that most ugly of all vampiri, whose habit it had been to foster running sores and festoons of boils all over his face and body in order that his aspect would be that much more terrifying. So Vols was here, eh? Scythus was somewhat surprised, for he had seen Lord Pinescu and Fess Ferenc crash their crippled flyers in clouds of dust on Starside's plain of boulders after the battle at the Dweller's Garden, and he'd thought that must be the end of them. Either that, or they'd have to travel north on foot. In Vols's case, obviously, he'd been wrong. Patently, the wily old devil had kept a flyer in reserve, just in case. And what of the Ferenc, as that one liked to be known? Could he also be here? Fess Ferenc, aye. One man or monster of which to be exceedingly wary. Standing 100 inches tall, the Ferenc would have dwarfed even the great she-bears which Scythus had killed for meat. And he alone of all the vampiri carried no gauntlet. No need, for his hands were murderous talons. Well, well, things might yet prove interesting in these terrible Icelands. Scythus sat in Vols's saddle and chewed on Bearheart, and he called his flyer.
Come, eat.
As his creature arrived and settled to the ice, Scythus got down and strode the circumference of the dead beast's body, and so discovered a great hole eaten into its side, where blood vessels as fat as his thumb had been sliced through and sucked upon, then tied off with knots, at which he rightly guessed that Vols Pinescu had survived his stricken mount, which begged the question, where was Vols now? Scythus extended his vampire awareness, sent out a sweeping telepathic probe, not to speak to anyone, but to listen for someone. He heard nothing, or perhaps the echo of a mine's or mine's shutters swiftly slammed shut. If Vols and Fess were here, they weren't speaking, and again Scythus smiled his sardonic smile. No one applauds a loser. It would be different if he had won the battle for the Dweller's Garden. But of course it would, for if he'd won, then he wouldn't be here. While his flyer feasted, Scythus looked up at the ice castle. The cold, glittering sculpture was mainly nature's work, but not all of it. The rims of crude steps cut into the ice had been rounded by time. They led up to an arched entrance under a facade of mighty icicles. Inside, the core was of stone, dark and uninviting. Scythus climbed the steps, entered the ice castle, was aware of crusted rim crunching under his feet, where at first he strode, then crept through a mazy ice labyrinth. For as he went, so he became aware that there was something dreadful here, or that something dreadful had happened here, and for the first time since the Dweller, he felt himself in awe of the unknown. The echoes were mainly his, but changed by the cavities and convolutions of the ice castle into dull bass grindings and slidings, like floes crushing together in a heaving sea, or great ice doors rumbling shut. And the moaning was the freezing wind echoing in the spires of the place, distorted and amplified by the ice into agonies of dying monsters.
Unless he were acclimatized.
Shaitha spoke to himself in a whisper, for company if for nothing else.
I cannot see how a man, even a vampire, might live here. Or he could, for a while, possibly through a span of 100 sun-ups, except here it is always sundown. But finally the cold would get him. Yes, and I can see how that would be. The aching cold creeping into his bones, until eventually even vampiric flesh would freeze, his heart beating even more slowly, pumping thickening ice crystal blood through shivering veins of arteries. At least he would stiffen and lose all mobility, and the ice wax upon him until finally he sat upon an ice throne within a glassy stalactite, thinking slow, frozen thoughts from the core of his ice brain. Being Vampiri, if he were Vampiri, he would not die, at least not until the ice shifted and sheared him, or ground him away. But what would that be for life? My ancestors disposed of their enemies in three ways. Those whom they scorned, they buried undead, to become fossils in their graves. Those who worked mischief against them, they banished to the Icelands. And those whom they feared were driven into the Sphere Gate on Starside. Who can say which penalty was the most severe? To go to hell, to turn to ice, or to stiffen into stone? I, for one, would not care to be a block of ice.
These thoughts, breathed aloud, were carried away as whispers, amplified and thrown back as gales of sound. It was like whispering in some echoing cavern or grotto, except that these caves of ice were that much more resonant. In the higher vaulted ceilings, icicles tinkled, then shivered into shards and came crashing down. Some were quite large, so that Shaithas must leap aside. At that, and when things had quietened a little, he decided to vacate the place, at which precise moment there sounded in his telepathic mind a far, faint, quavery voice.
Is it you, Shaithas, come after all this time to discover and devour me? Then you should know that I welcome it. I'm here, up here. Come get it over with. The cold centuries have chilled even my once fierce, vampiric passions. So come, make haste and snuff this last, low flickering flame.
Chapter 2. Exiles. Startled, Shaithas fell into a defensive crouch, turned in a slow circle, gazed all about. He saw only ice, but knew now for certain that this place contained more than that. And at last, crimson eyes slitted, he concentrated his own thoughts into a probe.
Who speaks?
What?
The infirm, quavery voice spoke again in his mind, and Shaithas sensed a derisory snort.
Don't make me laugh, Shaitan. You know well now who speaks, or have the long, lonely years addled your wits. K'rol Lugoz speaks, old fiend. We were exiled together. We dwelled a while in the caves of the cone. We were companions for as long as there was meat. But when the meat was finished, our friendship went with it. And I fled while I could. K'rol Lugoz.
Shaithas frowned as he strove to remember vampiric legends almost as old as the race itself. And this Shaitan, which the hidden speaker referred to, not the Shaitan, surely. He frowned again, and as suspicion turned to curiosity, asked,
Where are you?
Where I've been for... How long? preserved in the ice, undead, that's where I am, dreaming in my frozen hell of endless time. And you, Shaitan, how has it been for you? Has the cone kept you warm, or are its fires returned to drive you out?
Dreaming in a frozen hell, the very scenario Shaitus had conjured only a moment or two ago. Yes, and he believed that whoever this Kaerol Lugoz was who spoke to him, indeed he spoke from a dream. Perhaps the crashing of great icicles had roused him up somewhat from his sleep.
"You're wrong," he said then, relaxing a little, "for I am not Shaitan. A son of his sons, perhaps? But my name is Shaitus, not Shaitan."
"Oh!"
The other seemed to find his words bitterly amusing.
"The lord of liars, even to the end, eh? Shaitan? Perverse as ever? Aye, you were the worst of a bad lot. Well, what does it matter now? Come for me if you will, or be gone, and let me return to my dreaming."
The voice faded as its owner sank down again into permafrost dreams. But Shaitus, concentrating all of his vampire senses to their full, believed he located its source.
"I'm up here,"
that mental voice had told him at the onset, "somewhere up above." Shaitus was in the heart of the carved, wind-fretted ice castle now. There, locked in clear ice, all of 3 feet thick, he could see a massive central core of volcanic rock thrusting raggedly up like the ossified root of a glass tooth, a splash of stony spittle from the ancient volcano. And there, climbing the face of the ice sheath where it covered the castle's lava fountains, carved into its cold crystal contours, glassy steps wound up out of sight into grottos of gleaming ice. There was nothing for it but to follow them. The vampire lord mounted the frost-rimmed stairs and climbed to the jagged peak of the core, where its last black igneous fang pointed straight up, as if threatening to break out of its sheath. And staring through ice hard as stone, finally Shaitus spied the author of the mind messages he'd heard in the corridors below. There in blue gleaming heart of ice, seated upright in a lava niche, with one hand resting lightly upon a ridge of rock, as upon the arm of a favourite chair, a man ancient as time, weary, withered, and weird. Encased as surely as any fly in amber, his eyes were closed, his frozen body motionless, his mien severe as his fate. And yet he sat there proudly with his head held high upon a scrawny neck, and with that certain something in his aspect which spoke mutely but definitely of his origin, the fact that he was Vamphiri, Kaerol Lugoz, whoever he had been. No, whoever he still was. Shaitus put out a hand to the wall of smooth ice, pressed down hard until his palm was cold and flat. A minute went by, then another, until finally, thud. It was faint. So very faint and far-seeming, but it was still there, and after a pause of 2 more minutes, a thud, and so on. Kaerol Lugoz lived. However protracted his heartbeat, however fossilized his body, and it was very nearly fossilized, still he lived. Except, as Shaitus had already inquired of himself, what was this for life? He stared hard at the shriveled thing, studying it through 3 feet of ice, which, however pure, nevertheless blurred the picture and shifted its focus with Shaithus's every smallest motion. And now he believed he knew the answer to that other question he'd recently asked himself. Which was worse, to be buried undead, or sent into the Helllands, or banished here? And the vampire lord shriveled at the thought of all the nameless centuries gone by since Kaerol Lugoz had come up here and sat himself down and waited for the ice to form. Thud. And this time, because he'd been lost in his own thoughts and was startled, Shaitus snatched back his mind. Kaerol Lugoz was too old to even guess at his age. The Vamphiri, when they age, do not necessarily show it. Shaitus himself was more than 500 years of age, yet looked no older than a well-preserved 50. But in the face of privation such as this one had known, it simply couldn't be hidden. Yes, Lugoz looked almost as old as time. The eyebrows above his closed, steeply slanted eyes were bushy, white, locked in ice like the rest of him. His hair was white as a halo of snow over a brow, wrinkled and brown as a walnut, with white sideburns which frizzled out widely to half-obscure his conch-like ears. His ancient face was not so much wrinkled as grooved, mummified, like a trog kept over long in its cocoon until wasted. The grey cheeks were sunken in, the chin pointed, with a thin wisp of white beard fluffing there. High teeth, like fangs, overshot the withered lower lip. They were yellow, and the one on the left was broken. There'd been insufficient strength in the frozen vampire to grow another. The nostrils in the squat, convoluted nose, more properly a bat snout than was usual in most of the vampiri, showed signs of fretting. Disease, Scythus supposed. And a huge purple wen was visible bulging under the chin, like the puffed mating wattle of one of the sunside's birds. As for Caeror Logos's garb, he wore a simple black robe, its hood thrown back, wide sleeves flopping about his scrawny wrists, and hem loose around his chicken calves. Except, of course, the sleeves and hem were not loose, but frozen in ice, hard as stone. His hands, where they protruded from his robe, were extremely long-fingered, with sharp, pointed nails, and upon his right index he wore a large ring of gold. Scythus could not make out the sigil. Veins stood out white in the backs of his hands, instead of olive or purple. Before he froze himself, this one had gone without blood for long and long.
"Wake up," Scythus sent. "I want to know your history, your secrets. Indeed, for it would seem to me that you are Vampiri history. This Shaitan you speak of, do you mean Shaitan of the Unborn? He and his disciplines were banished to the Icelands in the very dawn of legends. But still here? How? No, I cannot believe it. Wake up, Caeror Lugoz, and answer my questions."
Nothing came back. The old thing in the ice had returned to his dreaming. His shriveled heart continued to thud, but it seemed to Scythus more slowly yet. He was dying. Longevity, even suspended animation, is not immortality.
"Damn you!"
Scythus snarled out loud. His curse echoed back to him, along with other echoes from the bowels of the ice castle. He waited until the echoes had died away, and only the weird moaning of ice winds remained, then sent out his vampire awareness all around. Was anyone there? Well, if there was someone, then he was adept at shielding his presence. Except, suddenly, Scythus remembered his flyer, which he'd left feeding, if someone should find it out there. He reached out his mind to the creature, discovered it gorging still, cursed long and loud, but this time silently, and to himself. He'd never get the beast aloft now, but at least he could send it away from here.
"Go," he commanded it. "Flop, waddle, squirm, slither, but go, westward, half a mile at least, and there hide. As best you can, anyway."
And in his mind he felt the stupid creature moving instantly to obey him. Then, satisfied that the flyer would put distance between itself, Volsi's dead creature, and what or whoever else might possibly be in the vicinity, Scythus returned to the problem at hand. Earlier, the old thing in the ice had been awakened by a fall of icicles. So be it. Exploring an upper terrace, the vampire lord found a vast spout of ice like a frozen waterfall, and at its fringe many lesser formations. One of these icicles, some 4 feet long and 9 inches through its stem, he snapped off and carried back to the ice-encased husk of Caeror Lugoz. Since the petrified old fool couldn't be roused by mental means, let him start awake at the entirely physical shattering of this great blade of ice against his sheath. Fully absorbed in his task, Scythus failed to detect the furtive approach of others up the ice staircase. He shouted telepathically at the frozen, ice-distorted figure where it sat.
Kira Lugos, wake up!
Then swung back his icicle hammer to smash it against the face of Lugos's sheath, but the great icicle refused to swing because something was impeding it. Hissing and spitting his shock from the red-ribbed vault of his throat out over the glistening, vibrating arch of his forked tongue, eyes bulging and crimson, and with his less than human features instinctively flowing into a fearsome, inhuman wolf mask, Scythus glanced back over his shoulder, then dropped the great icicle and reached for his gauntlet. But in that same instant a huge talon of a hand fell upon his wrist and trapped it, and Scythus stared into the grim grey faces of two fellow survivors from the battle for the Dweller's Garden, Fess Ferenc and Vols Pinescu. He snatched back his hand and stumbled away from them.
"Damn your hearts," he snarled, panting. "But you've learnt stealth, you two." "We heard a great many things,"
Vols Pinescu choked the words out past a huge scab of crusted pus which half sealed his lips, impeding his speech.
"Not least how the invincible vampire army of Scythus of the Vampiri could be burned and blasted and crushed, its eyries destroyed, and its survivors banished like whipped dogs into eternal wastelands of ice."
Vols's boil-festooned face turned purple with fury as he took a heavy, threatening step closer to Scythus. But the Ferenc's temper was less volatile. With his great height and strength and with his terrible hands, he didn't much need to work up a rage in himself.
"We've lost a great deal, Scythus," he rumbled. "Since coming here, it's dawned on us just how much."
"Aye, for this is a cold and lonely place."
"Cold?"
Scythus blustered.
"What is cold to the Vampiri? You'll get used to it."
Val strained his head forward aggressively, and a batch of boils on the left side of his neck burst and spurted their yellow pus onto the ice.
"Oh!"
he gurgled.
"Like he's got used to it, do you mean?"
He inclined his loathsome decorated head sharply towards Kaerol Lugos, seated motionless as a mountain not 3 impenetrable feet away.
"Him and all the others we found insisted in their echoing fortresses of ice."
"Others?"
Scythus looked uncertainly from Vols to Ferenc, then back again.
"Dozens of them,"
Fess Ferenc finally answered, nodding his huge, acromegalic head.
"All taken to the ice, crushed as straws, waiting out their time until some magical thrall shall come and free them into a land filled with life. Or until they die. For the cold of this place is not like the cold of Starside, Scythus. Here it goes on forever. Get used to it."
Now he echoed Vols Pinescu.
"Resist it? Warm ourselves? Stoke up our internal fires against it? But fires need fuel. The blood is the life. And with what do we sustain ourselves while we're getting used to it? Blood cools, Scythus, trickle by trickle, hour by hour. Limbs stiffen, and even the stoutest heart runs slow."
Now Vols took it up.
"You ask, what is cold to the Vampiri? How often were you cold on Starside, Scythus? I'll tell you, never. The heat of the hunt kept you warm, the blaze of battle, the soft salt blood of Trog or Traveller. Your bed was warm and welcoming at sun-up, as were the breaths and buttocks of the lusty women who sucked the steam from your tail. All of these things you had to keep you warm. We all had them. And we had a leader who said to us, 'Let's band together and take the Dweller's Garden.' Now, what have we got?"
Scythus looked at Ferenc, who shrugged and said,
We have been here longer than you. It is cold, and we grow colder. Worse, we grow hungry.
His voice was now a growl. Vols's hand touched the ugly gauntlet at his hip, tentatively, perhaps thoughtfully. It could mean anything, but Scythers backed away. And as the threatened lord plunged his hand into his own gauntlet and flexed it there, displaying its gleaming knives, rasps, and cutting edges, Fess Ferenc raised an eyebrow and rumbled,
2-1, Scythers. Do you like such odds, then?
Not necessarily, Scythers hissed, but I'll make sure you lose at least as much blood as you drink. Where's the profit in that?
Vuls grunted, coughed up yellow phlegm and spat it out.
I say it would be worth it.
He went into a crouch, and now he too wore his gauntlet. But the Ferenc only relaxed, stepped aside, shrugged again, and said,
Fight if you wish, you two. Myself I prefer to eat. Full bellies are less fierce, and brains with blood in them more capable of clever scheming.
His maxim might not fit men, but certainly was applicable to the Vampiri. Vuls, seeing he stood alone, thought twice, and...
Huh!
He snorted this time at Ferenc.
But it seems your mind schemes just as well when you're hungry, Fess. For if you were to fight Scythus and I, why, you'd sup on the loser, and so make yourself stronger than the winner.
He nodded and removed his gauntlet.
I'm no such fool.
The Ferenc scratched his jutting jaw and grinned, however grimly.
Strange, but I had always considered you just such a fool.
Scythus, still wary, hung his own gauntlet at his belt, finally nodded, and took out from his pouch a purple heart as big as his fist.
Here, if you're so hungry.
He tossed it over. Vuls snatched it from the air and closed slavering jaws upon it. But Ferenc only shook his head.
Red and spurting for me, he said.
Well, I can get it anyway.
Scythus frowned and narrowed his eyes suspiciously as the giant started down the ice steps.
What's your plan? He snapped. Who will you kill?
Not who, but what?
The Ferenc answered over his shoulder.
And I'll not kill it, but merely deplete it a little by little. I should think it's obvious.
Scythus and Vuls went skidding after him.
What?
Vuls questioned around a mouthful of bear heart.
Something's obvious.
The Ferenc glanced back at him.
What did you eat when you crashed your exhausted flyer here?
He said.
Aha!
Vuls spat out chunks of cold, dark flesh.
What?
Scythus grabbed the Ferenc's huge shoulder.
Are you talking about my flyer? Would you maroon me here forever?
The Ferenc paused, turned, looked him straight in the eye. 2 steps lower than Scythus, still the giant looked him in the eye.
And why not?
He answered.
Since it comes to me that you're the reason we're all marooned here.
No!
Scythus spat at him and stabbed again for his gauntlet, and the Ferenc at once swept him from the stairs. Scythus fell. 2 depleted and restricted for metamorphosis into an airfoil, he could only grit his teeth and wait for gravity to do its worst. On the way down, he struck several ice ledges but suffered no real damage, until at last he crashed down on his shoulder and chest in the snow, merciful snow. Blown in through an arched ice window, the drift was 3 or 4 feet deep with a thick crust of ice. Scythus crunched through the latter, compressed the former, wrenched his right shoulder, and broke a pair of recently healed ribs. And then he lay there in his agony and cursed Fess Ferenc from the depths of his black heart.
Curse me all you will, Scythus,
the Ferenc had heard him.
But I'm sure you'll think better of it. Of course you will. For it was you or your flyer, after all. Vuls would have chosen you, for there's a vampire in you, the very essence. But personally, I think it were better if you live. A little longer, at least.
Scythus stood up, staggered away, looked for a place to hide. He allowed his hurt to wash over him, deliberately conjuring all the agonies of his crash on Starside when he'd broken his body and face, and of his fight with the she-bears, to add to the pain of this latest tumble. And these were the false impressions of severe damage which he let flood out of him to be picked up and, hopefully, wrongly translated by Ferenc's vampire mind. Vols might conceivably read them too, but Scythus doubted it. The Boyle fancier was a dullard, too much obsessed with the manufacture of abscesses.
What?
The Ferenc seemed surprised, however uncaring.
That much pain? Did you crash down face first, Scythus?
He offered a grim mental chuckle.
Well, and now you know how I've felt all this time, for your face has always been hurtful to me.
Aye, Scythus could not restrain himself. Laugh long and loud, Fess Ferenc. But remember, he who laughs last.
The Ferenc's chuckling faded into Scythus's mind, and...
Not too seriously hurt, then. A pity, or perhaps you merely put a brave face on it. But in any case, I think a warning is in order. Don't interfere, Scythus. If you think to command your flyer into flight, forget it. For if we can't find your creature, then be sure we'll come back for you. Order it to attack us. Still, we'll triumph in the end. For as you know well enow, flyers make poor warriors, and our thoughts would stab it like arrows. And then we'd come back for you. But only let it be our way and make no protest. And for some time to come, well, at least you'll know where to go when you're hungry. And for as long as your flyer lasts, and provided we are not in the vicinity when you go to feed, then you shall last just precisely so long, Scythus of the Vampiri.
Scythus found a deep, sheltered ice niche in the castle's labyrinth and hid himself away. He wrapped himself in his cloak and toned down his vibrant vampire aura. Now must be a time of healing. Perhaps he would sleep and conserve his energy, and there was still a little bear heart left over for when he awakened. So long as he guarded his thoughts and his dreams alike, Vols Pănescu and Fess Ferenc could not find him. But first there was something he must know.
Why, Fess?
He sent out one last telepathic question.
You could have killed me, yet let me live, not out of the goodness of your heart, surely. So why?
Halfway down the ice stairs, the Ferenc smiled with a mouth almost as wide as his face.
You were ever a thinker, Scythus,
he answered.
Aye, and a clever one at that. Oh, you've made mistakes, certainly, but the man who never made a mistake never made anything. The way I see it, if there's a way out of this place, you'll find it. And when you do, I'll be right behind you.
And if I don't?
The Ferenc's mental shrug.
Blood is blood, Scythus, and yours is good and rich. Yet one thing be clearly understood. If this is as far as we go, if the ice is our destiny, then at last I shall be the one who sits encased awaiting the great thaw, Fess Ferenc and none other. But I shall not go hungry to my fate.
Two exiled Vampiri lords, one grotesque and huge, and the other hugely grotesque, left the glittering ice castle and sniffed the bitter air, then let their snouts guide them to Scythus's doomed beast. Meat was not the flyer's usual fare. Its diet would normally consist of crushed bones, grasses from the sunside, honey and other sweet liquids, and some blood. Having metamorphic flesh, however, it was capable of consuming almost anything organic. On this occasion, having gorged itself on the frozen flesh of another flyer, it must now rest until the food was digested and converted. Bloated, it no longer lay where the ex-lords had first spied it beside the gnawed carcass of Vols's flyer, but had found shelter slumped in the lee of a great block of ice, half a mile to the west, where Scythus had sent it. Forming great saucer eyes in its leathery flanks, the dull, stupid thing gloomed at Ferenc and Vols Pănescu, and lulled its diamond head at them as they approached. Moist and heavy-lidded, its eyes saw but could scarcely comprehend, until the flyer was instructed to do something, and then by its rightful master, Scythus himself. It would do nothing, not even think. Oh, it would seek to protect itself to a degree, but never so far as to harm one of the Vampiri. For stabs of concentrated vampire telepathy could sting such creatures like darts, bringing them to trembling submission in a moment. Thus, while the flyer would not fly for Fess or Vols, it would lie still for them, even when they sliced into its warm underbelly to sever great pipes of veins, which they would then suck upon. Scythus, in his niche in the ice castle, heard the huge creature's first mental bleat of distress and was tempted to issue orders such as,
"Roll, crush these men who torment you, bound up and fall upon them."
Even now, at a distance, he could transmit such commands and know that the flyer would instantly, instinctively obey him. But he also knew that while the beast might injure the lords, it could not kill them. And he remembered the Ferengh's warning. To set the flyer upon them, unless it could be guaranteed to incapacitate them utterly, would be to place himself in direct jeopardy. Which was why he ground his teeth a little, but otherwise lay still and did nothing. To Scythus it seemed a great waste, his good flyer used for food. Especially since Vols's flyer, literally 2 tons of excellent, if not especially appetizing meat, already lay out there going to waste. Except even that was not entirely true. Frozen, the creature would not waste, but remain available for long and long. But Scythus knew that there was more than mere hunger in it. The Ferengh had a purpose other than to fill his belly. For one, the beast would be left so depleted by this first gluttonous visit of Fess and Vols that any further aerial voyaging would be out of the question, which meant that Scythus was now stuck here no less than the others. It was partly the Frank's way of paying him back for his failure in the battle for the Dweller's Garden, but it was mainly something else. For the fact was that indeed Scythus had been the great thinker, with a capacity for scheming which had set him above and apart even from his own kind, the universally devious Vampiri. If any man could find his way out of the Icelands, then Scythus had to be the one. An escape which must likewise benefit Fess Ferengh, who would doubtless follow his lead, and, as Fess had so vividly pointed out, this was the reason Scythus's life had been spared, so that he could concentrate on the survival to the benefit of all the exiles. That all, of course, meaning Fess Ferengh specifically, for Scythus had no doubt but that eventually, unless there should occur some large and unforeseen reversal, the entirely loathsome Vols Peniscu must surely go the way of all flesh. As to why the Ferengh had so far suffered Vols to live, perhaps he simply couldn't abide the thought of eating him. Scythus allowed himself a grin, however pained and bitter, before re-examining the question of Vols's survival. A much more likely explanation would be the loneliness and boredom of these Icelands. Perhaps the giant Fess craved companionship. Certainly Scythus, in the short time he'd been here, had felt a great weight of loneliness pressing down upon him. Or had he? For all that this place appeared utterly dead and empty of any noteworthy intelligence, still he was not convinced. Even here in his ice niche, with his thoughts well shielded, still there was this instinctive tingle of awareness in his vampire being, a suspicion in his vampire mind that someone observed him in his trials. Possibly. But to know or suspect it was one thing, and to prove it another entirely. Wherefore, he would now sleep and let his vampire heal him, and later turn his attention to matters of more permanent survival. Not to mention a smaller matter of revenge, of course. Battering his mind more securely yet, Scythus settled down and for the first time felt the cold, the physical cold, beginning to bite. And he knew that Ferengh and Vols Peniscu had been correct. Even Vampiri flesh must eventually succumb to a chill such as that of these Icelands. There could be no denying it, not in the face of such evidence as Cairol Lugos. Then, even as Scythus made to close his right eye, for the left would remain open even in sleep, something small, soft and white, hovered for a moment before his face, finally darting away with tiny, near inaudible chittering cries to upper eyries of undisclosed ice, but not before Scythus had recognized it. Pink-eyed, that tiny flutterer, with membrane wings and a wrinkled pink-veined snout. A dwarf albino bat. It gave Scythus an idea. By now, Volspinescu and the Ferenc would be absorbed in their meal, probably numb from their gluttony. Scythus would risk opening his mind again. He reached out and called to the ice castle's bats, which eventually came to him. Fearful at first, finally they settled to him singly, then in twos and threes, and at last almost buried him in their soft, snowy blanket. An entire colony of creatures they crowded into Scythus's niche, and with their small bodies warming him, so he slept. The minion bats of Shaitan, the unborn, also called the fallen, not only warmed Scythus where he slept, but also watched him, as they had since his arrival. They had watched Fess Ferenc and Volspinescu too, also Arcus Leperson and his thralls, both of whom, within a period of just two auroral displays, Arcus had drained before secreting their bodiless corpses in cold storage in a glacier, and a pair of Menor Membites, lieutenants, released from thraldom by Menor's death in the battle for the garden. All of these had wended their various ways here, whose subsequent activities the miniature albinos had faithfully reported back to their immemorial master, Shaitan. The last mentioned duo, ex-travellers vampirized by Menor, had been the first of this fresh crop of exiles to get here. Having exhausted their dead master's finest flyer, they had crashed its panting, desiccated carcass in the salt sea at the edge of the Icelands and covered the last 30 miles afoot. Then they'd seen the smoke which Shaitan deliberately sent up from his chimney and dragged themselves to what might possibly be a warm place. Well, and it had proved warm enough. Now they turned slowly on bone hooks, suspended from the low ceiling of an ancient lava blowhole which opened on the volcano's west-facing flank. Shaitan's ice cavern larder. The lieutenants had been easy meat. They had no vampires in them. Their minds and flesh had been altered, but they were not yet vampiri. Given 100 years or more, and they might have been harder to take, but time had run out for them right here and now, along with all of their rich red blood. As for the four vampiri lords, Shaitan was rather more leery of them. Let them fight among themselves first, wear themselves out. It seemed only prudent. In his youth, which Shaitan scarcely remembered, it would have been different then. He'd have had the measure of all of these and four more just like them, but 3,500 years is a long time, and time takes its toll of more than memory. Indeed, of almost everything. Now he was tired. It must be admitted, even his vampire was tired, and his vampire was by far the greatest part of him. Not ailing, frail, or dying tired, just tired. Of the unrelenting cold which periodically would cut through the volcanic rock to the mountain's heart. Even to the blowhole caverns in its roots, of the interminably dull routine of existence, quite simply of the sameness and emptiness of being in these eternal, ageless Icelands. But not yet tired of life, not utterly. Certainly not to the extent that Shaitan would advertise his presence to such as Fess, Vols, Scythus, and Arcus Leperson. No, for when you came right down to it, there were plenty of better ways to die. Aye, and now that the exiles were here, there might be more and better reasons to stay alive too. Especially this Scythus. Indeed, with a name like that, he might even prove to be the realization, the embodiment of a totally new existence. This last was only a dream of Shaitan's, true, but it had not faded with time. While all else had turned grey, his dream had stayed clear and bright, and red. A dream of youth. Renewed vigour, a vigorous return to starside and sunside, and of laying them to waste, and then the invasion of worlds beyond. Shaitan's belief, his instinctive conviction that indeed such worlds existed, had sustained him through all the monotonous centuries of his exile, given purpose to that which was otherwise unattainable. But while the dream remained young and bright, the dreamer had grown old, and somewhat tarnished. Not in his mind, but in his body. The human part of Shaitan had wasted, been replaced by inhuman tissues. The metamorphosis of his vampire had transcended the deterioration of the host body until the man part had disappeared almost entirely, leaving only rudimentary or vestigial traces of the original flesh, organs and appendages. But the fused mind of man and vampire remained, and, for all that a great deal had been forgotten, still the accumulation of that mind's contents, its knowledge, was vast and evil. Shaitan's evil was fathomless, but he was not mad, for intelligence and evil are not incompatible. Indeed, they are complementary. The murderer requires a mind to construct his clever alibi. An idiot cannot build an atomic weapon. Evil is the perverse rejection of goodness, which in Shaitan was absolute. This was an evil which might put the universe itself to the torch, then gaze upon the cinders and find them good. He was darkness, light's opposite. He could even be said to be the primal darkness which opposed the primal light, which was the reason why even the Vanthiri had banished him. But he knew, without knowing how he knew, that he'd been banished long before that. Banished by good? By some benevolent god? No metagnostic. Still, Shaitan could conceive of such a one, for how may evil exist without good? But for now, he put such thoughts aside. He thought them for long enough. In 3,500 years, a mind has time to think many things, from the remotely trivial to the infinitely profound. For the moment, his origin was not important, but his destiny was.